You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here. My name's Madeline Bunting. I'm a writer, and I'm delighted to be chairing this talk this afternoon with Mathieu Ricard. It's a great pleasure to have Mathieu here. I think he's squeezed London in before he gets to America. So we're sort of part of a global tour, and I think it will be fascinating to see the response to this book. I'm sure some of you have had a chance to see it outside, but it's big, and it's big in every sense. Not only is it a large volume, but it's got a very, very big idea, and at the heart of the big idea is a big heart. And I have to say that I loved it. I kept plunging in at different points and sort of cheering, because it's a real counterblast. And in some ways, it's got a sort of Old Testament prophetic energy to it, a sort of challenge to a kind of cynicism and pessimism that's very present in many, many aspects of our culture. So this, it seems to me, reads as something that is full of optimism. Many of you, I suspect, will know a little bit about Mathieu. He's French, and he's obviously a Buddhist monk, so we're going through the really obvious bits first. And he's written several books which have had huge acclaim around the world. But he started as a scientist in cellular genetics, and then went to the Himalayas 40 years ago to study Buddhism, and that's where he's spent most of the last 40 years working in Tibet, Nepal, and another country, isn't it? India as well. Yeah. And he's going to talk today about altruism, in which he argues that compassion has the power to not just change our own lives, but the world around us too. So, over to you, Mathieu.
Wonderful. So, I'm very happy to be back here in London. And I have a presentation that sometimes I use in 4 minutes or in 6 hours. I didn't know exactly what was the time frame. But maybe, let's see, we start with some general ideas before I use some images to sort of ground the argument into some science and big ideas. So first of all, it would seem that there's no need to write a book to prove that selfishness exists. Because unfortunately, first of all, it exists for sure, but why writing a book on altruism? Because some people think that there's but nothing but selfishness, which I found to my great horror, was a quite prevalent idea. Not so much where I've been spending 45 years in Buddhist environment, because compassion and altruism is the heart of the Buddhist path, and I think in our lives. I cannot imagine that someone never had this kind of feeling of unconditional love for a child, for a loved one, for an animal, for someone far away, wishing only good to people who are victims of tragedies like the earthquake in Nepal, and that there is no other, you know, back door tours thinking, what can I get out of it, basically. So that seems quite obvious, but sometimes, since there are people, a respectable one, like Hobbes here, and a few others, as you will see, including many psychologists until 20, 30 years ago, who thought that, you know, scratch at the surface of an altruist, that the selfish will bleed. That means if you are really smart and look deep and can dig deep enough, you will find that nasty selfish motivation. And so forth. So first of all, philosophers, and I cannot go at length about that, has discarded that as first armchair science, because there's not a single scientific study that ever comforted that idea, rather the opposite. And also as a deeply logically flawed, because that means if everything is moved by selfishness, and you take that as a postulate, you can never prove anything, because you can always find some way. You know, it's like some kind of know, if it happened in psychologic therapy, for instance, and if you come early to the meeting with your therapist, he says you're sort of maniac obsessive or something. If you come right on time, you are also obsessed with the punctuality. And if you come late, you are afraid of coming here. So in any case, nothing works fine. So then in that case, you know, a scientific hypothesis has to leave space for being refuted by reality, which is not the case if you have this kind of overall theory that everybody is selfish and you can always propose something. It has to stand to the fact. So that was quite puzzled by this attitude because it doesn't fit with my personal and I think I hope everyone's experience. But then my hope was to first show that genuine altruism exists from different perspectives. And then see, well, that's not enough. How can we enhance it in society, going from individual transformation to societal change? Because that's the challenge. Because one may say, well, if you find altruism exists, and so what? Look at the world. You know, there's all these terrible things happening here and there. There's the rise of the narcissistic epidemic, as it was said in North America, sort of strong individualism. And then we hear, obviously, more about terrible things than good ones. Now, the banality of goodness is overlooked because if 100, 200 person go and do something nice today, you know, helping some elderly or doing some, you know, just being together nicely for 1 hour, nobody's going to speak that in the evening news. You know, 100 people cooperated to help, you know, some group of elderly. But if one of you go and rob a bank or attack the old lady in the street, you're sure you'll be in the news. So there's a distortion, probably because we need to be alerted to some extreme sort of fringe behavior that is potentially dangerous. And that's why at 20 years old, has seen 40,000 homicides, murders, or acts of violence on TV and movie in Western Europe and North America, which of course is nothing to do with what is our reality, everyday life. So, then why is, besides that, altruism an important concept? And that's why I think the main theme of the book is because if you look at the challenges of our modern times, there are many, of course. Some of them are personal. You know, we have to deal with our mind from morning till evening, and that mind can be our best friend or our worst enemy. That's quite clear. We see that. You know, we can feel complete distress in the little paradise and keep some resilience and joy of being alive even in the face of adverse circumstances. And then there's also, so maybe I will illustrate that. So we are often in kind of this situation, we're being at the edge of something. And so that could be, you know, that we are homeless. So the challenge of poverty in the midst of plenty. It's not that there's not, for, as Gandhi said, it's not that there's enough for everyone's need, but there's never be enough for everyone's greed. Therefore, when inequality keep on increasing, which is the case in all the OECD countries for the last 30 years, we're not going to remedy to that challenge. So that is happening. That's a challenge. And then we have the challenge of reconciling three time scales. Basically, the fast pace of the economy, you know, we tell you the balance sheet at the end of the month, at the end of the year, and it's moving faster and faster. And yet people will tell you that is the harsh reality. Everything has to be at the service of that. Instead of the economy being at the service of society, we have to make sure that economy works well. Otherwise, nothing else will work. Forget about national happiness. Forget about everything else. But is it that the case? And if a nation is the most powerful and the richest and everyone is unhappy, what's the point? Yes. So there is the fast pace of the economy. There is the mid sort of term of the quality of life, how you see your life and other people's life over 10 years, 20 years, a generation, a lifetime. And that matters, of course, the sense of fulfillment of having sort of a good life. And then there's a new challenge that has taken us by surprise, and I come back to this place, is that 10,000 years ago, there was 1 to 5 million human beings on Earth. So whatever they would do, you know, there's no way that they could inflict any serious damage to our planet. Now, since the Industrial Revolution, scientific revolution, technological progress, multiply by 1,000 our capacity to act on the outer world. And then we entered in 1950, the Anthropocene, the age where the activities of human beings become the major factor for the state of the planet. So that's taken us by surprise because nobody ever decided, I'm going personally to wreck the planet. So we don't feel responsible. It's a slow process. We don't see it happen. As one of my scientist friends said, if the CO2 could be pink and we see the sky becoming pinker and pinker, we might worry a little bit more. But something that happens in 30 years, emotionally, we are not equipped to react to this long-term danger. So there is a problem. There's also a problem of dialogue between the scientists, which are mostly seen as, you know, troublemakers when they tell the economists what should be changed to preserve the planet. And policymakers also are in trouble because they are worried with the next election, not next generation. So that's a deep issue. So what concept could allow a common platform of thinking so that at least they can have something to discuss to work together for this a better planet? And that's why, after meeting over many, many years, a lot of psychologists, specialists of the evolution, economists, specialists of the environment, name it, it emerged that the only concept that allows this common dialogue and not being completely dissociated is having more consideration for others, and there's nothing else. If you have more consideration for others, you will go more toward a caring economics, which is the only way to remedy to poverty in the midst of plenty, and to worry about the common goods, which are the quality of the air, of the oceans, because the homo economicus, that is to maximize your personal preference and interest, there's no way that you will take care of poverty in the midst of plenty or take care of the environment. And then if you have more consideration for others, you will make sure that life in society can be more harmonious, there's less inequalities, there's more social justice, that people can have access to education, to something that allows them to fulfill their potential and their deep aspirations. And of course, if you have more consideration for others, then you cannot ignore the fate of future generations, even if they are not alive today. So, I'm a Marxist, but of the Groucho tendency, not Karl. And Groucho said, why should I care for future generations? What do they do for me? But, you know, I heard an American billionaire saying the same thing on Fox News. He said, about the race of the ocean. He said, I find it absurd to change my behavior now for something that will happen in 100 years. So you get the serious version of Groucho Marx, but it's more tragic in a way. So the idea that we could continue to, you know, use all the resources of the planet at the exponential speed that we are continuing to increase is like this president of a country that will not name, it's not United Kingdom, as you can guess, who was saying about 10 years ago, 5 years ago, we were at the edge of the precipice. Now we made a big step forward. So that's exactly what the attitude of people who say, let's continue and let's grow. So now remember this limit here. There's going to be a tipping point, as you can imagine. So the scientists have recognized what they call planetary boundaries. And there's a number of factors that if they don't go over the bench, then we can continue to prosper for another 50,000 years in the Holocene, which has been exceptionally stable climate period for 10,000 years. That's why human civilization could flourish. Agriculture, all that happened just because of that exceptional period of stability. So if none of those goes too wild, then we could continue in that way. And that depends on activity. So in 1900, no big deal. We were well within the safety, even though it was not measured precisely, but we can guess what they were. 1950, you can see some of those are looming nearer from the limits, and then hold your breath just for a second, not too long. 2010, we vastly went over the border of safety. So just to take an example of biodiversity, it's not a prediction. At the current rate of disappearance of species, today's rate, every year, by 2050, we lost 30% of all species on Earth. And that's not going to stop, of course, at 2050. That's the sixth major extinction since the origin of life. The fifth one being that of the dinosaurs and many other species alone. So this is a real serious matter, because that will not just the disappearance of a few frogs and stuff like that, but it's completely upset the situation of the planet. So we are here, I'm sitting in front of a glacier in Bhutan. There are 2,000 glaciers melting in the Himalayas, the third pole, faster than the North Pole because there's dust settling on the glacier. So this is all something that is really looming, and you can see the speed of increase, for instance, of CO2 after 1950. And that is true for many other things, like the loss of rainforest. And I have about hundreds of those diagrams like that. It's all going up and up. And for instance, methane is an interesting case because it's 20 times more active to create greenhouse gas effect. And it's mostly due to livestock. It's the second cause of global warming after habitation and before transportation. And most of it, methane today, comes from livestock, raising livestock for meat, the whole chain of production from, you know, sending grains from the poor countries to the rich one. Why? Because like in the USA, there's 120 kilos of meat per habitants per year, with about 3 or 4 in India and 5 in Africa, 80 in Europe. And that's driven. So methane is, we won't expect, but it is now become the, according to IPCC report, the second cause of global warming. And that's, of course, has many aspects, ethical. We kill 100 billion land animals every year and 1,000 billion sea animals for our different kinds of use. It's an ethical problem. It's bad for the environment. It's bad for poverty because 700 million tons of grain has to be shipped from poor countries to rich ones to do that. So it's a kind of mess. And then, of course, ethically, it's not difficult to defend that. So is it because we are so selfish? Man is a wolf for man, as Plot would say. Well, the mistake is not to say that some people also are quite cruel and merciless. By the way, wolves are very nice social animals. Nothing wrong with them. I mean, the best friend of man, dog, just came straight from them. But the mistake is to say that every man is always a very cruel person for others, which is, of course, a complete distortion of reality. But, you know, great thinkers think that, or great thinkers, or whatever you might think of them. And if you go by this saying of Freud, you know, I've discovered very little good in humans. From what I know, most of them are rascals. So it's a bad start in life. But fortunately, I don't think it seems to be the case. And it's a very, of course, gloomy prediction. As we can see, in fact, human beings love to cooperate. I mean, the moment they start doing things together, there's a great enjoyment. If we see houses being built or people working in the fields in Bhutan or Nepal, when they come together for working on any field, then you will go to the next field and so forth. And even from the prehistoric times, act of cooperation is one of the great sources of joy. And it's not restricted to human beings, by the way. Of course, there's a struggle for life, the survival of the fittest. There's one winner and a loser. But if you look at recent work on evolution, I say Martin Novak and E.O. Wilson, who completely changed his view, by the way, after past 80, and they said that, you know, competition, of course, exists. We cannot deny that, predation, competition. But that in evolution, cooperation actually has been much more creative to get to increased levels of complexity, and that's played a major role in achieving what we are today. And we can see that also. You know, one of the chief factors contributing to well-being is the quality of human relationship. And that's all scientific studies have shown that. If you benefit from that good social positive network, higher longevity, less sickness, less addictions, and so forth. Also, it's not restricted to human beings. There was a study in Japan, one of the hotspots of centenarians. And what they found is that from birth throughout life until death, they're all together, they celebrate together, they help each other in times of need. So let's make a small pause. There's always people, as I said, trying to find selfish motivation to everything. So if you hear of someone who made a very generous donation, anonymous, for saving someone's life, a child's life, for instance, and, you know, there's no way that they could get something in return. They are not doing that to show off because it's anonymous. But they will confide to a friend, maybe a psychologist. I mean, I'm nothing against psychologists, of course, but those who promote universal selfishness, they say, you know, I feel so happy to have done that. I feel so good. They say, oh, you're doing that for the warm glow. You know, this is not altruistic at all. You're doing that because you feel good. You see people who work in the humanitarian world. Now, when we are volunteers, they come back and they said, oh, I got more than I was given to those people. So they say, you are selfish, basically. But is it always true that it is the warm glow? So look at this, for instance. So you think those guys, when they went there, they said, oh, I'm going to feel so good when this is finished? You know, it's funny because I just come from Buenos Aires, and when I showed the first movie, one lady said, oh, but this is the train I take every day. You know, this is the train of the suburbial train. So anyway, so then, but then you interview those people and they tell you, oh, you know, I had no choice. I had to help this person. How could I leave that person being killed? And those universal selfishness psychologists come, ha-ha, you automatic behavior, neither selfish nor altruistic. It's automatic behavior. But what does that mean? There's no choice. Of course there's a choice, but that choice doesn't take much time, right? If you are here, this guy's not going to think for half an hour, should I lend my hand, not do it? What he might think? Maybe his lawyer's going to sue me if I miss it or break his little finger or something. So, of course not. I mean, you do it instantly. There is a choice. And there is a choice. Look at this one. He has a choice. And tell he has no choice? Doesn't make sense. Then there are people who had choice, and over a long time, and the face of big danger, and there was no question of feeling good and warm glow. This is the pastor André Trogmé and his wife. During the Second World War, they saved, with the whole village of Chambon-sur-Lignon in Haute-Loire in France, 3,500 Jewish persons, helped them to reach to Switzerland. There was threats on their life, on their family's life. They never make any concession. They did that. So not for the warm glow, not to get anything in return. So this being said, psychologist Daniel Batson spent 20 years putting people in many odd circumstances and conditions and show how they behave in certain conditions, giving them an easy escape, see if they would take something out of being proud of having helped someone. And he tested 30 different hypotheses to see if the selfishness hypothesis will win. And in every single case, and so far, nobody has been able to offer a new explanation on the selfish range. He found that there was a significant number of people, no matter what, will behave according to the empathic concern or altruistic hypothesis. So altruism does exist, which is a good news. Then, of course, we have empathy, you know, feeling either joyful when someone is joyful or feeling sorrow when someone has pain, and that may lead to burnout. And the work we did with neuroscientist Tanya Singer in Leipzig, we could show that empathy and compassion and altruistic love is different in the brain. And in fact, that burnout, and I don't have time to explain in detail, come from empathic distress, which is just empathy all the time. This is this emotional resonance with the pain of others. But you could buffer that with altruistic love. And she's about to launch a program that could be used, immense use in the medical world to prevent burnout, which is very prevalent. And you can see, actually, naturally, some people, some doctors, nurses, they are very warm-hearted and they don't suffer the burnout. This somehow came to us through, given by evolution, through parental care, maternal love. But on the platform of that was given by evolution, we can then extend that further. There are many cases where a skill that is given us by evolution could be used to other and further purpose. And again, this is not only limited to human beings. So the question is, can we change on individual level? And then we can ask, can we change on societal level? So if individual cannot change, then, you know, you just have to put strong institution, you know, abolish slavery against their wish, prevent them from going through a red light against their wish. It's all about top-down sort of totalitarian system. That's not going to make people altruistic, neither happy, nor anything else. So we need individual change, if you want, to enhance that capacity of altruism that we do have as a potential. Everyone's heart has some place for altruism. So the question was, in the contemplative science of Buddhism, which I know I heard a little bit about, this has been done for 2,500 years. But of course, since they may, so good for you. Now you are in the hermitage, cultivating compassion, and the world is still going on. So the idea was to have a collaboration with modern science to see if there was some real change or if those people are just daydreaming in their hermitage. So some students of the great masters like Kensei Rinpoche and Khandru Rinpoche, our two teachers, or the Dalai Lama, now went to the lab for the last 15 years now and collaborated with, now there are many studies have been done on the effect of mind training, which is probably the most acceptable name for meditation, familiarizing yourself with a certain skill, with a quality, cultivating altruistic love, for instance. And it has been now clearly shown through using either electroencephalogram or like fMRI, like this is Miguel Rinpoche, another great teacher, or they also need bad guinea pigs to make sure that to see what happens when the people cannot meditate properly, like myself. So here with Rishi Davidson, who did for 15 years those studies. But it has been shown that there's a remarkable difference between trained people and untrained ones. Here is a control group of novice, nice persons who have not trained in this type of meditation on compassion, addressed here, and when they engage in compassion meditation, as you see, not much happen. In the, you know, long-term meditators address the rest, and when they engage in compassion, there's a huge peak of brain activity that you don't find in novices. Same with the brain imaging here addressed for the meditators. When they engage in compassion, several areas are activated. In the novices, nothing addressed, nothing in meditation, that's normal. They have not trained. But you might say, okay, good for you, 60,000 hours of meditation. Basically, who's going to do that? The good news is that if you do 4 weeks, 20 minutes a day, which is more accessible, there's already a structural change in your brain. The hippocampus has changed in size. This is an area of the brain that assimilates novelty. And then control group hasn't changed. And I was just in a taxi. We asked the driver if he still has to learn 40,000 streets by heart, which of course in Paris, none of them do. They hardly know 10 without the GPS. He said yes. And the first study which shows the neuroplasticity was done with taxi drivers, or Londonian taxi drivers, and the same area of the brain, the hippocampus, was bigger because this is also represent a training of visualizing the outer world. So you see, you could do that with learning 14,000 streets, but you can do that here by mindfulness meditation and by caring meditation and so forth. You can also do that with children. This is a program in Madison, Wisconsin with preschoolers, 10 weeks, 40 minutes, 3 times a week on caring mindfulness, prosocial behavior, mostly on the altruistic love, compassion and gratitude and so forth. So, you know, 4 or 5 years old, you know, they love that, but so what? Well, after 10 weeks, increase of prosocial behavior is significant in those kids compared to a control group. And then came the ultimate scientific test, the stickers test. So for that, we determine who is the best child in the, you take a child in the class, and for each of them, who is their best friend, least favorite child, unknown child, and the sick child. 4 envelopes, a bunch of stickers, say, please give the sticker away. So as you can guess, before the intervention, they give everything to their best friend. Now, will it make any difference? No, discrimination are so strong, in-group, out-group, you know, Manchester United and Arsenal fans, you know, and everything about race, about social background, everything is very strong in society. Well, after 10 weeks, it's basically leveled. They give equally to their best friend and to the child that they could not stand. So that's quite amazing that you could do that with such, you know, young people. So individual change is definitely possible. So for us also, we say, can we put that in action? So that's why we founded this organization 15 years ago, Karuna Session. Now we accomplish 140 projects. We treat 220,000 patients every year in our clinics, and 25,000 kids are in the school. Recently in Nepal, we made a special effort about the earthquake. We had, a news update yesterday. Now we have helped 45,000 people in 100 villages over the last month. So we're getting all the donations from wonderful solidarity that we could see since the earthquake. So we have this clinic in Nepal that is 50 people working there. They are full-time now busy with the earthquake relief. We have also a clinic in Bihar in India that treats 80,000 patients a year. We build school with bamboos. We help a social entrepreneur. We build 9 schools, each of them for 2,000 kids, 60% girls. And it's not so expensive because it's all with bamboos. In Tibet also, with the help of Raphael, who is here, we built 20 dispensaries. And we build bridges, of course. We need a bridge, obviously. And so we build 18 bridges. We take care of the elderly. This is the happiest man in the world. He is a doctor, Tibetan doctor, but not an ophthalmologist and not a dentist, as you can see. And so schools, and so this is a wonderful thing. So then recently in Nepal, of course, the tragedy. So many people are homeless and they have no food. So we bring trucks for delivery, and our clinics and even the monks got very much involved for last month. So this was a 2010 earthquake in Yushu in Tibet. So we helped two local NGO people to go to the winter. We brought 6 trucks of goods. We are building this year an anti-seismic school at 12,000 feet in eastern Tibet. So now the question is, what can we do? Well, this is nothing to do with the rest of the talk. You know, I'm a photographer, so photographers always try to put their photos anywhere. But to come back, this is our Karuna girl, and she's there 12 years later. So now, how can we go to conclude from individual change to societal change? They need an articulation point. And if we hope that the genes will change, it will take 50,000 years if it works to get an altruistic gene. It's too late for the environment. Fortunately, and that was a big discovery I made when researching for the book, I came upon this idea through a common friend of evolution of cultures. And that goes faster than genes. So there's a lot of work that's being done. There's a book called Not by Gene Alone, which shows that within a generation or two, you can deeply change the attitude of people. And there's a tipping point. Look at slavery. I think here in 1789, 10 people decided we want to abolish slavery. Everybody thought it's crazy. No, I think the parliament said there's no way the British Empire will collapse economically if we abolish slavery. 10 years later, it was done. Likewise, a number of determined people, they said we should have a universal declaration of human rights. 10 years later, it was done. So culture can change. That's the good news. So then what do we need to do that? We need to enhance cooperation, go to a higher level. We're already super cooperators, but need to go to yet another level. We need to bring cooperative learning in schools. It is done in some places in UK, and it's wonderful. We need to have more cooperation within enterprise. Our friend Richard Lyall, which I'm going to see tonight, he says it would be unconditional cooperation within a company or enterprise. There could be competition between different companies, but not within an organization. We need to have a sustainable harmony. Sustainable growth is suspicious now because people always think of quantitative growth. It can only be qualitative growth, and the concept of sustainable harmony reflects that better. Harmony for now means reducing inequalities. Harmony for the future, keeping in harmony with the environment, and that can be sustainable. We need caring economics, again, for the two reasons that the pursuit of selfishness, which, of course, the Homo economicus is really a caricature of human beings. We are not just pursuing our personal interest, but still, you know, it's floating around. So what about the Homo altericus? So we need to care about poverty in the midst of plenty and the common goods. And Denis Snower, who is founder of the Global Economic Symposium, he made that his main idea of action is to bring about the notion of caring economics, and a few others do that as well. We need local commitment and global responsibility. We need to our enhanced cooperation again, and we need to extend altruism to the 1.3 million other species. They are our co-citizens in this world. They are not just there to make us happy or just for our needs. And so, as Martin Luther King said, to conclude, everyone must decide whether he will work in the light of creative altruism or in the darkness of destructive selfishness. And I think people like the Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King, and Gandhi otherwise have exemplified that in their life. So there can be compassion in action with wisdom. And I think that's our hope. And it's not just being optimistic, although of course it's too late now to be pessimistic, but it's really recognizing the potential for individual and societal change. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Natia. And speaking personally, I love the photos as well, so thanks for throwing those in. I wanted to just press you on the mechanism for change. So you say the individual can change, and you showed us the experiments of Richard Davidson about the changes in the structure of the brain. Now, is there a sort of sequential process to this, that the individuals need to change and there needs to be a sort of critical mass of individuals?
Yes, critical mass is the main issue. You know, there's an interesting point about critical mass going from individual to societal, and it's precisely to do with the evolution of culture. First, evolution of culture is cumulative. We don't have to learn everything again. Otherwise, I would not know how to fabricate that and use that. It is goes to education, to example, also to imitation. And that's a very important point. Human beings like to imitate. You know, there's a saying, if you want not to make any blunder in Rome, when you go to Rome, do what the Romans do, and then you are pretty safe. So there was a study quite interesting about asking people, are you ready to do something for the environment? 20% says yes, no matter what. I mean, I will change my heating system in the house. I will be careful about this and that. 20% says, I don't care a damn. You know, I will do what I want. They will find new technology. You know, this whole thing, the human beings are so resourceful. You know, of course, 30% species disappear. Even if you are resourceful, what do you do about that? Nothing, basically. You will see. Of course, we can adapt. At what cost? You know, the Lord Nicholas Stern's report said it will cost 20 times more to repair the damage than to do something now. 200 million climate refugees, you know, Lampedusa is going to look at nothing compared to that. So we can adapt, but at cost of how many suffering. So therefore, you know, so 20% say I don't care. So that's those who, you know, don't care about future generation, full stop. 60% say I'm ready to do something if others do it. So that's, of course, those you need to sway. So culture is a lot about the default mode. What is acceptable? Now, today, if someone says, you know, it's too bad that they abolished slavery, you know, it was quite convenient after all. Now, nobody can say that. I mean, people still practice slavery. There are a few million people in slavery yet, but basically nobody dare to say that. It's not possible. So that you need to bring that change. So what is a default mode? It's very interesting. It's what is generally accepted. I'll give you an example. There was an environment conference, and they give a kind of questionnaire, and you can tick if you want vegetarian food. So people don't know, people concerned with the environment, you know, there might be quite a lot, 20% only. Oh, man, it's kind of strange. So next year, they did the same thing, and they said, if you don't want vegetarian food, you know, tick the... And then only 20% wanted meat. So the 80% said, okay, with vegetarians. That was the given by default, and you had to make a special thing to eat meat and change that. So that's why we need to create something that default mode is against racism, against sexism, against all those things, homophobia, whatever, is no more the thing we can say openly that is, you know, we like slavery and that's it. Or women should no more have the right to vote. You know, it won't work. So, therefore, that's why there's a change, that somehow there's a tipping point that comes from a critical change of individual, but doesn't have to be the majority from the start. It's just the idea has to be sufficiently clear and convincing, you know, precisely to make a case that's the only way out. I mean, to remedy to those difficulties so that people say, okay, now to say that I don't care. That's why I like caring economics. You know, if you go to economists in Davos and tell them, you know, you should be compassionate and altruistic. They say, okay, fine, you know, I can build my life, but it's not what the economy is about. And even though this year at Davos, the first speech of the opening by Klaus Schwab, the founder of Davos, said, let's put this week under the sign of caring and compassion. I mean, relatively, it was nice to hear that. It's not just about the euro and the Greek crisis. And so at some point, you know, even, someone who's working in hedge funds in New York say, we know altruism, I like it, but it's not what I do every day. But if you say, I don't care for poverty, I don't care for the other moment, no, it's something we can't say anymore. So those things happen like that.
But I think what I'm kind of trying to understand is the sort of process of change, because the sort of rhetoric of people who turn up at Davos and say that they care about climate change, we're left a little jaded from that rhetoric, yes, because it doesn't translate into actions.
So the problem with culture, I just
wondered whether you felt that meditation and mindfulness was going to be the critical agent of change.
Well, I mean, personal change, all are needed. It would come from individual. Society is made of individuals. Now, meditation as mind training, yes. As meditation as some exotic things, probably not. Mindfulness alone, I doubt, should be caring mindfulness. I've been arguing again and again with my good friend John Kabat-Zinn. Please add those five letters. Otherwise, mindfulness could go wrong. You know, you could have a mindful sniper. Very mindful, you know. Always controlling his emotion, you know, coming back when he's distracted. You could have a mindful psychopath. But you cannot have a caring sniper and a caring psychopath. So those can have a major change. But I think cultural change does take a little time. It takes at least a generation or 20 years. And that's why the dilemma about the urgency of the environment is that we all somehow wish that to happen. It's the major challenge of our times. But, you know, to really be determined, because it's going to sort of hurt the way we... But still, it is the unnecessary high consumption of the rich country, because USA produced 200 times more CO2 per inhabitant than Zambia. So this disproportion is like insane. And that's why it happens. So it has to be a curve on the sort of unnecessary sort of luxury of consumption that is driving that. It's not the Zambian people who do that. It's not the Afghani. Afghan emission of CO2 is 2,000 times less than Qatar.
I'm going to open the conversation up.
Thank you very much, Matthew, for that wonderful talk. Following on a bit from the conversation you've been having, I work for the Student Wellbeing Service in a university where we have lots of students studying finance, economics, and they're all going to go and work in the corporate world. I mean, what would you say to these young people who individually they want to be nice and kind and look after for the environment, but they want to go make money and be ambitious and successful for themselves and become hedge fund managers? What should I be telling them? And should I be running lots of loving kindness meditation courses, or should I be making the intellectual case as you've done? Tell me what I should be doing in my job.
Okay. If you could pass the microphone along to the gentleman next to you, yeah.
Good afternoon, Ben Harvey Fellow. A lot of what you're talking about is building on Gandhian and Schumacher economics and the idea of almost like Scandinavian economics as well, of sustained growth over a long period of time and community values and things like that. How does this build into your idea of corporate social responsibility and the responsibility that corporations have as well?
Yes, my question is, if you look at the constellation and conjunction of forces that are now present in our consciousness, is there a particular focus that one should be looking at? For example, you've mentioned biodiversity with the loss of species, which is going to be going on, as you say, anyway. Is that a primary area of focus? If one has one life to live and you have a certain amount of time in your life, what should you be doing to concentrate? Where should you be concentrating? That's my question.
Great. I've made notes, so if you've forgotten any of the questions, yeah, that's right. And we need another round, several more rounds of questions, Matthew. So succinctly.
For the first question, you know, I have a friend who teaches at the Harvard Business School. It's called Jeff Walker. He worked for J.P. Morgan before and also for the foundation. And he said, you know, 20 years ago, it was 100% Wall Street. No, that was the goal. He says now 30% of his students are coming to him and say, you know, I would like to use these capacities I've learned here to go somewhere in the humanitarian world or into some social... What would you think of how can I use my capacity? So, you know, this is a sign, and it's just one sign. But I think the kind of disposition is there in the students. You just have to find, offer them a possibility, a way that's not just only. There's nothing wrong with being a hedge fund manager because money is a tool, and the tool can be used to build or destroy. It could do wonderful thing. You know, if you give me $1 billion, I know exactly what we could do to help everywhere we do. So there's not a problem about, you know, using it for the wrong right way. So what is encouraging me is not just only that, Harvard Business School, but on all walks of life from everywhere. I see this idea, now we should have more cooperative learning in the schools. So it's from all these different disciplines, you see this coming, and that's the encouraging factor to me. It's not just a few people, but it's kind of coming from below, you know, steaming up like something is happening in that direction. So that's what I feel is encouraging. And also, if you think of evolution, So basically, it selects the trait that is more favorable for survival. It's almost like automatic. And wouldn't it be that the trait which is the most likely to help us to survive would be more cooperation than competition? And therefore, it may happen just by itself. Now, for the second aspect, can you remember your question?
Economics, how does it fit? Your ideas around economics, how does it fit into...
Yes, so of course, more is beautiful and all that. This is going that way. The idea that, you know, if we look for more of that increasing quality than quantity, that simple idea would fit in the picture. So in a way, the idea of getting more prosperous is somehow to get more well-being. Again, otherwise, as I said in the beginning, the most powerful and the richest and everyone miserable, nobody would see the point of doing that. So the idea is ultimately is going to bring well-being.
But the role of corporations specifically, I think that's your question, wasn't it?
Well, sorry. So it seems that now, among all the different economic sector, what some people call positive economy or pro-social economy, it's about, let's say, 7%. That includes cooperative banking, crowdfunding, macrocredit, you know, impact investing, socially responsible, environmentally responsible. So that, you know, 7% is not small, but it's not huge. But it is the most vibrant and fastest growing sector. And it's also the one for people who invest in that is most resilient. I was told, in time of crisis, people who have a sense of it's worth, you know, maintaining that, there's ethical funds, they somehow seems to be doing better, I was told. And if you see the expansion of that, you know, I met I was at a table, one of those Davos dinner with a very nice young lady, she's about 27, okay, I could guess, and I said, oh, what do you do? She said, I'm the co-founder of Kiva. No, she was this very young, nice person, and Kiva went from zero to now $5 billion a year of micro lending in 5 years. So these things are really expanding fast, and I think that's a good sign. Now, for the final one, you know, of course, in 20 minutes, hard to go, but you will see there's a section which is probably too big. That's why the book is big, about the contrary forces in the book, the source of violence, you know, excessive individualism, how we go from devalorizing others to dehumanizing them, to desensitizing ourselves to suffering, de-individualizing them to mass massacres and genocide and so forth. What are psychopaths? What's the problem with psychopaths? So all those contrary forces. But still, within that, there was interesting points. Of course, this also happened within ourselves. And interesting points was that the idea that was proposed, say, strongly by Konrad Lorenz and Freud, that we have this very strong innate tendency for violence that we need to repress. That science has never shown that to be true. There's the potential for that to happen, definitely. But the fact that we have constantly have to push on the brake, that's turned out not to be quite correct. So we have contrary forces because there's the potential for that. There are reasons for that, why that happened. It's mostly devalorizing others. I mean, if you accord value to another sentient beings based on the fact that I don't wake up in the morning thinking, may I suffer my whole life and the whole day, well, then you think, well, even others seems to be very unskillful in what they do, quite deluded sometimes, like I am myself, but yet deep within, no one wants to suffer. I value this aspiration in me. Why should I not value in others? Because any act of violence comes from depreciating others in the beginning, whether it's a moral dissociation. There are many mechanisms that have been studied, you know, and it's always about devalorizing others. Otherwise, you will be concerned by their well-being and their suffering. So that tendency, and just to conclude, there's this beautiful saying, you know, sometimes it's ancient Americans, Indians, sometimes you find it in another story. But anyway, whatever the story comes from is quite a nice one. It's a grandfather and his grandson that says to his grandson, you know, there are two wolves in ourselves. One is a very kind wolf and one is a very sort of cruel wolf. And there's a constant fight within ourselves and within society between this tendency to harm and this tendency to do good. And then he described the fight with those two wolves. And then the child at the end said, but Granda, who is going to win? And he says, the one you feed. So in a way, that's why mind training is important. Because if you do cultivate, you know, caring economics, caring mindfulness, of course, why not? and altruistic care, introducing caring mindfulness in enterprise and in business school. No, it's not something like silly just for boys' schools. It's such a deep need in our life. And you look in the medical world, the remedy to burnout being the training on compassion. In the course of my, I'm almost 70, I met so many wonderful people, my spiritual teacher, someone like the Dalai Lama, who is the living example of that. And then all fields. And I'm deeply now, believe that, for instance, there cannot be selfish happiness. And in fact, the notion of a good heart, the Dalai Lama says, my religion is good heart, is the thing that we basically take care of most of our ills, whether it's short-term, not taking care of poverty, the mid-term, quality of life. In a way, this kind of altruistic love is the best way also to make yourself happy. You get that as a bonus on top of being the best thing you can do for others. So I would say, and I'm so always inspired by seeing how the Dalai Lama, that becomes his only message now in public talks, the more compassionate heart, that this will be, if there's one thing that we could do, is to cultivate that potential in us, somehow it will take care of our personal relations, decrease conflict, we're a better person in society. If that goes more global, among our deciders and all that, that will be the ideal scenario. So why not going for that? Because that's clearly the thing that should be enhanced. And that could happen, that would be so wonderful. So,
let's take another round of questions. There's a gentleman right in the front.
Can you tell me how you feel when you're at the very best of your meditation?
I wish that would happen more often. I'm teasing.
Thank you for your talk. Just piggybacking on your final point there, I think that ethical education is the key to a lot of what you're talking about. Now, one of the problems with that is a slight squeamishness about how you educate ethics in a multicultural situation. And I think that His Holiness's book on secular ethics, amongst other things, is quite a good guide to that. The second thing, I think, and certainly policymakers have a problem with this, is whether implicit education is better than explicit education. Is there any research, are there any findings on whether you just let this sort of education osmotically improve people, or you sit people round and you actually do this demonstrably?
Grace Cramer, so you talked about the 7% of business that was pro-social. What action would you recommend for the 93% of other business to kind of enhance altruism and create altruism within those organizations?
Okay, so, speaking about my meditation compared to that of great beings, it's like, we say it's like comparing a donkey running after one of those wonderful racing horses. But when I do retreats, and I have time to do that, I think and I don't have very fancy mystical experiences, but there's an immense joy in just practicing itself. And thinking of my teachers, thinking of the teachings, and trying to implement that. So there's a great sense of every moment has a special quality. And compared to many occasions where a day passes, a lot of accumulation of small, sort of little bit disheveled, chaotic things, which is almost like, what did I do today? I think to spend a certain time, engaging in, say, altruistic love meditation, it feels like a slowly flowing river of melting gold. There's a deep appreciation of every moment that passes by. So that's one thing. I think that is, I should notice, the deep sort of sense that time is so valuable when you engage in that. And that should follow, of course, by transforming your way of being. Now, about education, maybe it's not a very good answer, but what to do? So, about the education, in England here, for instance, you have the value-based education of Neil Hawkes. It has been evaluated over 30 years, and I was told recently that 10% of all schools apply that. So, multiculturally, it's really no problem at all. Because, when you people say in Pakistan that you don't impose on us Western values and blah, blah, things like that. But who would be against honesty, kind behavior, being tolerant or frank to each other, means these basic values that any culture, actually all the different religions and cultures are supposed to be building upon that. So they're much more fundamental. You know, compassion is more fundamental than any religion, although it's at the heart of every religion. So in a way, this secular, what the Dalai Lama calls secular ethics, I think the idea that we should be worried about Putin back in schools is kind of, I think, a bit silly. And the notion of neutrality is so silly because the kids will not be neutral anyway. They will get the values from somewhere else, whether it's violent computer games or something else, which won't do any good. Now, implicit thing is good if the culture goes toward that. In the culture, say, of nonviolence is a strong value, like in the best of the Buddhist culture. Of course, not all Buddhists are nonviolent, unfortunately. But basically, there is this culture of nonviolence against human beings, animals, and the environment. So, like you will see little, when people walk in a mountain track and the parents will show to the kid, if there's a bird crossing, you take it on a leaf and put it outside, and the kids love that. They see that, for example, that work. But in a society where there's so many input, so the implicit, of course, get mixed. You get, you know, for instance, just take the idea of computer games. It's been shown by thousands of studies how it increases aggressivity in the short term and in the long term. So then you get implicit learning of another kind. And then finally, what was the...
The last question was about businesses. How can they do compassion?
Yes, so again, you know, compassion, altruistic love, you know, in business it might seem a little bit too sort of airy. But I think caring is a good... That's why I like the notion of caring economics, because, again, you say, well, you know, altruism is nice, but what has to do with what we do? But you can say I don't care. So caring for others, I think this is a powerful concept. It goes toward a lot of addresses the issues, you know, about the flaws of some aspects of you know, of business, which is too much oriented only to profit and not using the human dimension. Now, I heard many times Muhammad Yunus say, if profit is the only thing that you wish at the end of the day, you are so much, you know, diminishing. So it's a kind of a caricature.
So isn't there
a reductionist view of human beings.
So isn't there a quite sort of radical critique of capitalism in what you're saying? I mean, capitalism can't become caring, can it?
Well, it depends what kind of capitalism, you know. Again, Denis Snowers is quite a well-known economist, and people who take care about inequality like Stiglitz or Amartya Sen, I mean, they got Nobel Prize of Economy after all. Well, the idea that, I don't think so, because it doesn't impinge on the idea of a free exchange and things like that. It's simply that you don't have this caricature that we can only work on maximizing personal interest and that nothing else. Because if the invisible hand is that of a blind, selfish person, we are in trouble. An idea that only the voice of reason exists in the economy is so silly, because all the studies of investors which are in the heat of investing, you know.
But given that capitalism is inherently competitive, it's always about making more profit than the next person.
You could see it in many ways. Competitive, maybe to keep the price low for the benefit of the consumers, but it is many ways of being competitive. Nasty competition and just to emulation to do better, to offer better services. Without squeezing everyone in the enterprise. So there's a kind of spirit that can be done of some place where it's, by the way, there are many studies showing that a working place, you know, in companies, whether it's investment companies or any big community that is a company, where it's a good place to work, people feel not under complete squeeze, pressure, stress, out, professional burnout. A good place to work, again and again, it has been shown that those companies flourish better. Because, of course, if people sort of feel nice and not just like, again, I have to go with those nasty people who are just about my, you know. And the worst case, you know, supposed to be what they call social Darwinism applied to companies, was the case of, Enron. And what they were doing is asking everybody to note everyone else they knew 1 to 5 stars every month. And if you have 1 star over 6 months, you will be fired automatically. So imagine the kind of atmosphere of delation and unease and lack of trust. So to bring back trust, to bring back some kind of satisfaction to work, this is based on a more open-minded, you know, pro-social. So the idea of caring, I think the idea of caring is very powerful. And it is in the interest of everything, is that we forget about Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments, where he says that a society without cooperation and benevolence will collapse. So that's a book which seems to be forgotten among Adam Smith other works.
Selected Adam Smith. Any more questions? Yeah, there's a few.
A lot of people have asked questions about what can we do and how can you direct us to do more. And I'm reminded of Gregory Bateson's phrase or quote, which is, notice the change and amplify it. And I'm wondering whether one of the things you might guide us to do is to notice more when compassion and altruism and collaboration happen, and to be a beacon for emphasising that, noticing it, and to amplify that in our own lives.
So, you know, there are people who bring big idea change, you know, like who did a lot, you know, Martin Luther King and Gandhi, you know, one determined person. And then they are the way it suffuses to the rest of society. The good point about altruism is that altruistic like to get together and collaborate. That's the big advantage. You know, they sort of attract each other a little bit. And if you look at the evolution again, you know, of the kind of group evolution, if you put one-to-one a selfish person with the altruistic, the altruistic person will be wiped out. They always, someone will try to abuse them and pull the blanket to themselves. So it will not work. But a group of altruistic people who cooperate, they have a strong selective advantage of a group of selfish people who kick each other's leg all day long. So therefore, that's how it's possible to work. Individual change make you a better altruistic person. You tend to aggregate with similarly minded person, and it could be now with the virtual world, you know, the thing we got from Nepal, we got help from all over the world to help those 45,000 people. This is a kind of virtual network which also comes true when we meet people face to face.
Thank you very much. Many, many thanks for a very stimulating talk. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.